Well, we've come to the third study in our series working through the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. And this morning we're in the last part of chapter 1. And we're going to look at this section under two headings. First of all, God's supreme creation, verses 26 to 28. And secondly, God's abundant provision, verses 29 to 30. So first of all then, this morning, God's supreme creation in verses 26 to 28. And the vast majority of our time this morning will be devoted to this first point. We'll only be passing a couple of quick remarks on the second point right at the end. God's supreme creation then. And I'm referring here, of course, to man. Man is God's supreme creation. Now, this is probably insulting your intelligence somewhat, but I'll just clarify at the outset anyway that when I use the word man, I'm not using it in any way relating to gender, in the same way that Genesis 1 here, when it uses the word man, is not using it in any way relating to gender. It becomes clear in verse 27 that the word encompasses both male and female human beings. And some people then like to try and find another word which captures this gender inclusiveness better, like humankind or something like that. But it seems to me that man is still the most straightforward and the least cumbersome word, and so we'll be using it this morning. Now, we said last week that in our insistence upon the uniqueness of man, we mustn't be blind to the fact man has some things in common with other parts of the creation. We mentioned that man doesn't have a separate day devoted to him. He's made on the sixth day, the same day as the land animals. We mentioned too that he shares the same descriptive term, living soul, with both the sea animals and also, again, the land animals. And we mentioned too that in his very physical composition, made from the dust of the ground, there's a very obvious connection with the creation around him. And so, as I say then, we mustn't be blind when insisting upon the uniqueness of man. We mustn't be blind to these factors. But having said all that, we must, of course, insist upon the uniqueness of man. And this indeed is the most important point of all. This is absolutely non-negotiable. It comes across, doesn't it, in different ways in the passage here. For one thing, there's the fact that man here seems to be the final piece, doesn't he, of the creation. I mentioned just now that, yes, to be sure, he shares this final sixth day with the land animals. But he does seem to be reserved, doesn't he, until the last part of the sixth day. You get a sense here that man is the climactic culmination of the whole thing. That man is the creator's crowning achievement, if you like. He is the best that has been left until last. And so that, I think, points in the direction of man's uniqueness. Then again, we have this very distinctive introduction, don't we, to verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man." Now, throughout the preceding verses in Genesis 1, you've basically had creative command after creative command after creative command, haven't you? And it's all been really quite relentless. It's been very unremitting. You might almost say God hasn't so much as paused for breath. But here now in verse 26, he does. Here now in verse 26, the pace changes. Because here now in verse 26, we don't have a creative command. In actual fact, God doesn't create man, does he, until verse 27. Here in verse 26, what we have is simply a proposal that man should be created. Now, in the first 25 verses, we haven't had any time for proposals. There it's all been, let there be this, let there be that, let the land produce this, let the water produce that, and so on. No proposals. But here now, in verse 26, the pace changes, things slow down, and God makes a proposal. Now, when we ask the question, to whom does he make this proposal? We're getting ourselves into rather mysterious territory, aren't we? We've said several times in the previous two studies that throughout Genesis 1, Moses insists emphatically upon God's uniqueness, that we don't have here a pantheon of deities creating the heavens and the earth. We just have the one and only God that there is. And in the light then of that insistent emphasis, this word us here in verse 26, it jars somewhat, doesn't it? It's the last thing that you're expecting in Genesis chapter 1. It comes completely as a surprise. And it seems to me that whatever this word us would have meant here to Moses and to the Israelites of his day, and it's really very difficult to know what it would have meant to Moses and to the Israelites of his day, it can only be fully explained in the light of the New Testament revelation, when, of course, it becomes clear, doesn't it, that the one God is more than one person. He is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But I'm saying then that this change of pace, God now not simply creating man, but first of all talking about creating man, that is another pointer, surely, to man's uniqueness. And then again, we have this remarkable phrase, don't we? In verse 26, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. This concept of man being created in the image and likeness of God. God created man, in other words, somehow to resemble himself. When he created the animals, the sea creatures, the land animals, all the animals, he simply delved into his own infinite imagination to do so. He didn't use any model. He didn't use any templates. He wasn't working, as we might say, from anything else. But now as he creates man, it's different. Now as he creates man, he models man on something else. Remarkably, he models man on himself. And so in that too then, we see surely a pointer toward man's uniqueness. So I'm saying then that in various ways, this passage is pointing us to a remarkable and outstanding uniqueness. Man is different. Man is distinct. Man stands out. We might put it this way, that in all of God's creation, man possesses an unrivaled dignity. And you know, it's almost impossible, I think, to overemphasize this. It is so vitally, vitally important. Do you remember how Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, describes his disciples, doesn't he, as the salt of the earth? And his underlying point then is that society, left to itself, in its default setting, if you like, society will always decay. Without restraints, society will always, always decay. And just then, as you apply salt to meat, so that to some extent at least the salt will preserve the meat from decay, in the same way, Jesus is saying, one of the functions of the church is to preserve society from decay. Now, this, of course, has to be done in different ways at different points in history. But if there's one single area in which the church has had to function as salt almost unbrokenly throughout the past two millennia, It's surely in this area here, it's in this whole area of man's dignity, of man's uniqueness. Man's dignity is always under assault. And man's dignity, therefore, is always in need of the church's defense and of the church's preservation. We must, therefore, as Christians, we must be clear on this matter of the uniqueness and dignity of man. Now, if we're going to be clear on this matter of the dignity of man, I think that we have to particularly grapple with this idea, this concept that I mentioned a moment ago, of God's image, God's likeness in man. Because that, I think, is really the key to man's inherent dignity, the image, the likeness of God in him. Now, I suppose that at this point I ought to lay my cards on the table and admit that I don't know what this divine likeness in human beings actually is. I don't know. I have an inkling as to what it might be. You often hear it said in Christian circles, don't you, that as human beings we are self-conscious, we have extraordinary capacities to reason. We have a great sense of beauty in things. We sustain a rich emotional life, and so on. And the animals don't share these things with us. And surely then it's in these noblest aspects of our humanness that the divine likeness resides. And that seems to me very plausible. And so, as I say, I have an inkling that that may well indeed be what the divine likeness in human beings is. But the point is that I'm unwilling to say too much because the Bible doesn't tell us, does it? The Bible never says, well, the divine likeness resides in our self-consciousness and our reasoning capacities and our ability to appreciate beauty and our rich emotional life. The Bible never says that. And so I'm a little wary about going too unreservedly down a road which has little biblical control over it. But what I can say is two things about this divine likeness in human beings. First of all, it conveys to us a permanent dignity. It conveys to us a permanent dignity. Now, in just two chapters' time, in Genesis chapter 3, we're going to have this momentous development. Sin is going to enter the creation. And like a huge tidal wave, like a huge tsunami, sin is going to damage everything in its path. And not least, it's going to damage man. And yet, for all that, even sin isn't going to destroy the divine likeness in human beings. Even sin isn't going to remove man's essential dignity. How do I know that? Well, I know it simply because the Bible continues to speak of man as possessing the image of God beyond Genesis chapter 3. It continues to assume that man possesses the likeness of his maker. I'll just mention two passages. I'm not going to quote them because we're going to return to them later on. But just to flag them up, Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, where God is talking to Noah, and James chapter 3, verse 9. And both of those passages assume that man still possesses the likeness of God. Indeed, they're meaningless if that's not the case. Apart from that assumption, they are meaningless passages. And both of them, of course, are relating to life this side of the fall. So that's the first thing that we can say for sure about this divine likeness, that it conveys a permanent dignity, a dignity that wasn't swept away by the great disaster of Genesis chapter 3. Second thing we can say is that it conveys to us a real dignity. It conveys to us a real dignity. Because while, as I say, the Bible may not be clear on the precise content of the divine likeness in human beings, it is clear about the implications of the divine likeness in human beings. It is clear on the implications. And I'm just going to mention two implications of this divine likeness in human beings. First of all, it means we rule over the creation. We rule over the creation. Verse 26, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over the creatures that move along the ground. Now this concept would, I think, have been quite comprehensible to the Israelites of Moses' day, whom he, of course, was originally addressing. Because you see, there in the ancient Near East, you had superpowers. Egypt, from which the Israelites had just been delivered, was an obvious one. And the emperors, or in Egypt's case, the pharaohs of these superpowers, were constantly invading other smaller nations and turning those nations into vassal states. In other words, states which retained a degree of independence, but which ultimately were under the rule of the emperor, and which therefore had to pay annual financial tribute to the overruling emperor or pharaoh. Now this, of course, was a very desirable arrangement for emperors or pharaohs there in the ancient Near East. Except that the problematical aspect of it was keeping these vassal states, these conquered nations, under control. When you yourself, of course, weren't personally resident there, you were back in your palace in the capital city of the whole empire, it was quite difficult keeping control of these little conquered nations round about the place. And so one thing that they would do then, in order to facilitate this, was this. They would leave images of themselves, statues of themselves, images of themselves in all these different conquered nations. Representations, if you like, of themselves that were kind of there on their behalf. And the idea was then that the regular sight of this image of the emperor would solemnize the peoples of these conquered nations and would curb any rebellious tendencies in them. And God here, I think, is employing the same kind of idea. And God here is saying in Genesis 1 that in order to keep my creation under control, I have left within it an image of myself. Only in my case, it's not some lifeless, static image made of wood or stone or metal. In my case, it's a living image. It's an animate, competent image. It's man. And he will actually rule the creation, therefore, on my behalf. He, as my representative, he as there on my behalf, will rule the creation for me. And so, as I say, it would have been, I think, a readily comprehensible concept for these Israelites in Moses' day. But when we come to ask the question then, which of course is the important question, what does this actually mean in practice? What does it mean then for man, as God's image bearer, to be ruling the creation on his behalf? We have to answer that question, I think, very carefully. On the one hand, we must notice that it is fleshed out a bit for us in verse 28. There we read, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. So that's what this ruling over the creation involves? It involves subduing the creation. Now, in our terminology, that word subdue often has the idea, doesn't it, of some kind of opposition and resistance. If you're having to subdue something, you're having to subdue it again. You're having to subdue some form of opposition. But of course, that can't be the case here, because here sin hasn't yet entered the world. Here the fall hasn't yet happened. There are no oppositional and resistant forces within the creation. So what is God saying then? Well, he's saying, I think, that man is to make use of the creation. He is to use it to its full potential. He is to get the most out of it. He is to harness all the potential, all the resources that are inherent within the creation. He is to discover and make use of building materials. He is to discover and make use of fuels and energy sources. He is to discover and make use of possibilities for making paper and for making jewelry and for making musical instruments and for making means of transport. And so we could go on. God is saying, look, I'm putting the creation at your disposal. All of it. Fill the earth, he says. Go to all its frontiers and beyond all its frontiers. And use the entire creation. Harness all the resources that are there. Use all the potential that I have locked into it as its maker and creator. He's saying then that you should engage in scientific experimentation. He's saying that you should pursue technological advance. He's saying that you should master this creation in its entirety. So that's one aspect that we must emphasize, that God is here giving a warrant, he's giving a mandate for scientific exploration and for technological engagement. But on the other hand, we must also emphasize that in biblical terms, this word rule never is an exploitative and oppressive thing. I suppose this comes out perhaps nowhere more strongly than in Psalm 72. In Psalm 72, you have ideal kingship, ideal rule, ideal government. It's ultimately going to be realized, of course, only in the Messiah himself. And we read then in verses 12 to 14 of Psalm 72, he will deliver the needy who cry out, the afflicted who have no one to help. He will take pity on the weak and the needy and save the needy from death. He will rescue them from oppression and violence, for precious is their blood in his sight. And this then is the perfect kind of rule in biblical terms, a rule that is sensitive to need, a rule that is gentle, a rule that is compassionate, a rule that is fair, a rule that is, as I say, never exploitative and oppressive. And when, therefore, God says here that man is to rule over the creation, it means that man is to rule in that kind of way. He's to rule sensitively. He is to rule gently. He is to rule compassionately. He is not to ransack the creation. He is not to denude it. He is not to strip it bare. He is to rule it in conformity with this concept of government that you find throughout the Bible. And this means then that we need to avoid extremes, don't we, when it comes to this matter. On the one hand, we must avoid the kind of extreme that you get sometimes from animal rights groups, for instance, who give the impression that animal rights are equal with human rights, and that any kind of scientific exploration, therefore, any kind of lifestyle even, that impinges at all upon the animal population is intrinsically wrong before we've ever even had any debate about it. And we must insist, well, God didn't say to the fish of the sea, you rule over the creation. He didn't say to the lions, you rule over the creation. He didn't say to rhubarb plants, you rule over the creation. He said it to man. And man, therefore, is the ruler and the king of creation. But then again, we must avoid the other extreme as well, which basically takes the view that profit, financial profit, is all that matters. We must make more profit. We must become more wealthy. We must become more profitable. And if that means sacrificing the creation, if that means that it has to suffer, if that means that it has to become this bare place, shorn of all its beauties, and indeed ultimately shorn of its usefulness even, then we must, of course, stand against that as well. That's wrong too. So we must avoid both these extremes. God has told us as human beings, bearing his image, to rule over the creation, to cultivate it, and to master it, and to harness it. But at the same time, to do that in a way that is consistent with ruling throughout the Bible, gentle, caring, understanding, considerate rule. So that's the first implication. It means we rule over the creation. Second implication, it means we treat people properly. The image of God, the divine likeness in us, means we treat people properly. Now this is where those two verses that I mentioned earlier on come in. First, you might want to look at them with me. It's entirely up to you. First of all, I'm going to refer to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6. And here then, the divine image means that we don't murder people. God says there, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. So that's clearly saying then that the reason that murder is so heinous, the reason that murder is so abhorrent, and the reason that it has attached to it such a severe and serious penalty, capital punishment here, the reason is that man is made in the image of God. And perhaps at this point you begin to see something of the rationale, something of the sense of the Bible never saying to us precisely in what the image of God consists. Because imagine it had. Imagine the Bible had said to us, well, we are made in the image of God, and that means that we have these reasoning capacities, we have a rich emotional life, we appreciate beauty, we are self-conscious, and all the rest of it. Imagine the Bible had said that quite explicitly. It would then be quite easy to argue, wouldn't it? Well, look, there's that unborn embryo in the womb, and it's not self-conscious, and it doesn't have great reasoning capacities, and it doesn't appreciate much beauty, and it doesn't have a rich emotional life, and therefore there's nothing particularly objectionable about just wiping it out. And it would be easy to say, well, there's this severely disabled, severely handicapped person, and that person doesn't really have great reasoning capacities, perhaps. And that person perhaps can't appreciate some things to the extent that other people can. And so, again, there's nothing particularly objectionable about just wiping that person out. Or here you have this very elderly person who's dying and has lost the will to live and is miserable and depressed. And that person certainly isn't appreciating beauty in anything. And so, again, there's nothing particularly objectionable about just wiping that person out. But you see, God hasn't left the door open for discriminating between those human beings who do bear the image of God and those human beings who don't. He simply says that man bears the image of God. Human beings bear the image of God. And therefore, if there's any humanness at all, it might be embryonic humanness. It might be disabled humanness. It might be elderly and dying humanness. But if there's any humanness at all, the image of God is there. And to wipe that person out is, therefore, murder. So, that's the first thing when it comes to treating people properly. Murder is out. Murder is discounted. But it also means that other things are discounted in our relations with other people. Turn now to James chapter 3. James chapter 3 and verse 9. Where James writes, "With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness." So the image of God then, the likeness of God in human beings, doesn't simply mean that we can't murder them. We can do everything else as long as we fall short of murdering them. No, James says it means we can't curse them either. We can't, in other words, hate them. We can't want the worst to befall them. That person who really, really irritates you, that person whom you find really, really obnoxious, that person whose cockiness just really gets at you. James is saying, hang on a minute, that person bears the image of God. You must not, you dare not disrespect that person and violate that person's dignity. We're always hearing these days, aren't we, about antisocial behaviour. I read in the paper just this past week that it may soon be possible when you're buying a house not only to inquire about the flood risks and about what pylons there may be in the vicinity and that kind of thing, but also to inquire how many complaints there have been of antisocial behaviour in that neighbourhood in the past few years. Antisocial behaviour is clearly an enormous problem. And all sorts of parties try to counter this problem in all sorts of ways. And generally, it basically comes back to this, doesn't it? Let's be nice to everyone, because it's nice to be nice to everyone. And society will be much better if we're nice to everyone. And it's all so nebulous like that. But you see, in reality, it's only Christians, actually, who have a proper basis for treating other people properly. And the basis is this, that every single human being we ever come across, we recognize as being made in the image of God. And how dare we, therefore, do anything that would be disrespectful and that would constitute mistreatment toward that person. And so, I'm saying then that while I'm unwilling to identify precisely what the divine likeness in us is, we can say two things. We can say it's permanent, and it communicates therefore a permanent dignity. And we can say it conveys to us a real dignity. It has real implications, one of which is that we rule over the creation, and the other of which is that we must treat other people properly. Just three other quick thoughts before we leave this matter of the image of God. First quick thought, that it's remarkable, isn't it, that here in Genesis 1 we read God made man in his own image. It's utterly extraordinary, it's utterly remarkable, and it testifies, doesn't it, to the way in which God values human beings, even putting on them his own image. But you know, as the Bible unfolds, you come across something even more extraordinary than that. And as you come to the writings of the Apostle Paul, and as you come particularly to Philippians chapter 2, you read of something even more extraordinary. Not simply of man bearing God's image, but of God, at a certain point in history, assuming man's image, man's likeness. He, being in the form of God, was made, Paul tells us, in human likeness. And that's the ultimate extraordinary phenomenon, is it not? And if the first thing testifies to the value God places on human beings, does that not testify to the extraordinary love God bears for human beings, that he was even willing to condescend and take upon himself in the person of his Son their likeness to save them? Second quick thought. We read again in various places in the New Testament of the ultimate goal of our salvation being conformity to God's likeness, or sometimes Christ's likeness. I'm not going to turn to passages, we haven't got time, but I'll just mention references so that you can look them up if you wish. But in Ephesians 4:24 and Colossians 3:10, we have the idea of us being conformed to God's likeness. And then in 2 Corinthians 3:18 and in 1 John 3:2, we have the idea of us being conformed to Christ's likeness. This is the ultimate goal, then, of our salvation. It, of course, begins now, but it will not be perfected until the end. But you might ask, well, what does this mean? Because we've been saying this morning that we already possess the image of God. We already possess his likeness. So what can it mean, therefore, that the goal of our salvation is to possess God's image and God's likeness? We already have this, surely. Well, I think the point is that ultimately as Christians, we are going to bear God's image in an even better and an even fuller way than Adam did at the beginning. Because we are going to bear God's moral image. We are going to bear God's image even in our very characters. And that, I think, is going beyond what was true of Adam. Adam, of course, don't get me wrong, was sinless. Adam wasn't a sinner. He never sinned before the fall. But Adam, I think, did not possess God's moral image in the way in which we shall as believers. Because you think about it, there's even a whole new standard now, isn't there? There's a whole new benchmark of Christ's image or God's likeness, which simply didn't exist in the Garden of Eden. You go to Philippians chapter 3 and verse 10, and what is Paul's great aspiration in life? What is his great goal? It's this: to become like Christ in his death. To become like the crucified Christ. Now that was a standard of godlikeness that simply wasn't there. Didn't exist in the Garden of Eden. Adam wasn't like God to that extent. He wasn't like the God we see at Calvary. The God utterly self-emptying and utterly self-abandoning and utterly self-giving in his love and grace and mercy. Adam's likeness to God wasn't like that, but ours will be. And ours increasingly is as we go on in life. We are increasingly like Christ even in his death. That is a divine image bearing beyond anything Adam, I think, ever knew. Third quick thought. Jesus' words in the passage I read earlier on in our service, Matthew chapter 22. It's an interesting passage, isn't it? Where the Pharisees, you remember, try to catch Jesus out, and they, on this matter of taxes, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Remember Jesus' amazing response, show me a coin. Whose image, he says. Doesn't come out in the NIV, that word, but it's there. Whose image is on the coin? And they say, Caesar's. It's Caesar's image. Well, Jesus says, give it to Caesar then. Give to Caesar what belongs to him. If it bears his image, he owns it. It belongs to him. And I want to challenge you this morning. Perhaps you're not a Christian. Perhaps you're not a believer. I want to ask you simply this one question. Whose image do you bear? Do you not bear the image of God? And does that not mean then that God has a right to you. Just as Caesar has a right to coins that bear his image, God has a right to human beings that bear his image. He owns you. And you ought, therefore, to surrender that life which you're currently living for yourself as though it's yours and offer it up to him as his because he owns you. So God's supreme creation. Well, I mentioned that it would just be a couple of comments, barely even that, on our second matter, God's abundant provision in verses 29 and 30, because there we have this wonderful spectacle, don't we, of God then giving to man and then to the beast as well, to the rest of the creation, food to eat, giving the resources of the earth for his diet, for his sustenance. And I just want to point out that this is the first indication we get, isn't it, in Genesis 1, of the stance, if you like, which God has toward his creation. We've seen him putting the creation together, but we haven't really had any sense of what his stance toward it is and is going to be. Yes, we've seen him ultimately populate it with human beings, but what's he doing here? Is he perhaps simply making one huge cosmic concentration camp in which he's then going to sit back and enjoy the spectacle of man struggling to eat anything, struggling to find food to eat, man starving and becoming emaciated? And perhaps every now and again he'll place a plate of stale bread in front of man. Is that the kind of model that God is going to pursue? The concentration camp kind of model? Well, here now, in verses 29 and 30, we discover that the answer is emphatically no. That God's stance toward his creation is one of goodwill. It's one of goodwill. It's one of generosity. It's one of liberality. He wants man and the rest of the creation to enjoy the resources and be well sustained and well fed by them. And that's wonderful in its own setting there in Genesis 1. But it's even more wonderful, when you think that beyond Genesis chapter 3, beyond the fall, that same goodwill that we're seeing in its genesis, in its embryonic form in chapter 1, is going to step up several gears. And that same generosity, that same liberality, is even going to provide a saviour and a salvation for fallen, sinful men and women. If you like, Genesis 1, 29 and 30 are simply the first tiny little unveiling, uncovering of God's generosity and liberality. And the rest of the story, the rest of the Bible's unfolding story, is going to take that generosity on to ever greater and greater heights until eventually it's going to be expressed in its most astonishing form, just outside of Jerusalem, on one Friday, when God himself is going to hang between two thieves, bearing the sins of his rebel creation. What a God! To him be all the glory. Amen.